next. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very happy, first of all, to have sitting across from me in the studios, Nan Calvert, our good friend who joins us every month with a program under the auspices of the United Environmental Council. And on today's program, we have our other guest joining us via the telephone. And Nan, I want you to say a word about Heather Holm, this guest that you are so excited about.
Well, thanks. And thanks for having me back. I like being your friend, Greg. This is wonderful. Yes. So as we were talking before, Heather sings the song of my people, as it were. I found out about Heather, I think, a couple of years ago. And kind of at the same time, I was talking to people about native pollinators. And I started doing that because everybody talks about honeybees and the plight of the honeybee. And that's an important thing. And they certainly are being very negatively impacted by a number of factors. And it's, you know, something that we have to pay attention to because it represents people's livelihoods. And, you know, honeybees certainly pollinate a lot of our food crops. But we also have native pollinators. We have myriad numbers of native pollinators that nobody talks about. Nobody seems to know about them. And then I found out about Heather's book and certainly have gone through it from cover to cover and back again. And then I gave her a call, and she happily, she agreed to be on the radio with us.
Very good. So so we're talking about Heather Holm, who is a landscape designer and consultant who specializes in native plants, creating landscapes dominated by native plants, and also helps people with native plant and prairie restoration. And the book which Nan was referring to is called Pollinators of Native Plants: Attract, Observe, and Identify Pollinators and Beneficial Insects with Native Plants. It's a beautiful book, which is published by Pollination Press. Now, how's that? And I'm so excited that via the telephone we can speak with Heather Holm. Heather Holm, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be on the program.
Great. Ahead of us talking about the process of pollination and so on, and all of the ways in which this can be achieved a bit more naturally, let's find out a little bit about you. Where do you come from, first of all, originally, and at what point did you start to become interested not only in the natural world around you, but especially this wonderful world of native plants?
Sure. I tell people I've done a big triangle. So I grew up north of Toronto in Canada, lived in Maryland for several years, and I've been in Minnesota for over 10 years now.
Where in Minnesota?
I live in the Twin Cities area in Minnesota. And so I've always been interested in nature and plants, of course. I studied horticulture. But for using native plants, I've been using them for about 15 years. And once you start to use native plants in the landscape, you really start to see a lot of insect diversity. Insects are a lot more attracted to native plants in many cases. So I think that's what got me really interested in pollinators and eventually writing the book.
What got you so interested in plants right off the bat?
Well, I've always been interested in plants, but it's kind of funny. Where I grew up was on a pretty gravelly site and not very good for growing anything. But I used to help my grandfather with his vegetable garden and just always liked being outside. My dad was a land surveyor, so he was always outside and teaching me what kinds of trees were. And so that just started a love of being outdoors and enjoying nature.
Well, you've certainly taken it into an exciting arena. And Nan, remind us again, you kind of touched on this, but how did you first come across Heather Holmes and her work and her book?
Well, it was probably via Wild Ones. And then I met a fellow who lives here in Wisconsin. He lives out in East Troy, who builds all kinds of beautiful, gorgeous, artistic mason bee boxes. And Heather will no doubt talk about mason bees, but they're a very important native pollinator. So he and I were chatting one day, and he happened to have a copy of Heather's book. And so that's how I found out about it.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
Well, ahead of us even talking specifically about native pollinators, maybe we should really take apart this process called pollination. And I can't imagine that there are any of our listeners out there that don't have at least a rough notion of what happens with pollination. But, of course, for as simple a process as it is, it's also a really fascinating one with some really intriguing details. So, Heather, why don't you get us started by just laying out exactly what the process of pollination involves?
Sure. So flowers have both, depending on the flower, they'll have male and female reproductive parts. So the insect is primarily responsible for picking up pollen, which is the male parts of the pollination process, and transferring that to the female parts of the flower. So, and then fertilization occurs of the ovules, and then seeds form in a plant. So the insects are, in a sense, the vector carrying the male genes from one plant to the next. Some plants can produce seed from their own pollen without it being transferred by an insect, but the pollen, if it is transferred by an insect, is and then cross-pollinated, and it produces better genetic results.
One of the things you mentioned in your book is how various plants offer what we might think of as rewards, which essentially attract the attention of various insects that might serve as pollinators. What kinds of rewards are we talking about?
Right, so flowers are essentially a food buffet to insects who are looking for those types of foods. So they're offering pollen and nectar. And depending on the kind of insect that visits a flower, they're looking for different materials. The female bees are the ones who are actively visiting flowers to comb and collect pollen to take back to their nests. But other insect visitors, like butterflies, for example, they're only visiting flowers typically to feed on nectar. And it's just happenstance if they do pick up pollen grains while they're visiting for nectar and transfer those pollen grains to another flower. So they're a little less effective in many cases of pollinating plants because, unlike bees, who are collecting the pollen and literally getting coated with pollen as they visit flowers, there's a much higher chance that a bee will carry that pollen to another flower versus a butterfly.
Right. So the one is, in a sense, more of an accidental pollinator.
Right.
What is the function of pollen with a bee? Why is a bee interested in pollen?
Pollen and combined with nectar is what a female bee collects and deposits in her nest, and she'll mix those two ingredients together, and that's what her larvae feed on. So that's their sole diet. So bees, we like to say, are vegetarians, and so they are related to wasps, but wasps are primarily carnivorous, feeding on other insects. And bees have evolved to become vegetarian, so the pollen in flowers is their primary source of protein. So when the larvae eat the pollen, that's their protein, and nectar is their source of carbohydrates.
Hmm.
So they're getting a balanced and complete diet with those two ingredients.
Right. So that would be the buffet. That's one reward. Talk for a moment about the visual rewards, which some plants also seem to use to attract pollinators.
Oh, right. So plants want to lure, especially if their pollen needs to be outcrossed, they want to lure pollinators to their flowers, and they've devised a number of different ways. There's some visual things to attract them, such as nectar guides or stripes in the flower opening. So something to catch a pollinator's eye to lure them to the flower. There's also just the color itself can be more attractive depending on the kind of flower. And what's interesting, a lot of insects, including bees and butterflies, see colors very differently than we humans do. So a flower that appears purple to us may be a completely different color, more vibrant or less vibrant to a bee or butterfly. So there's a number of different things visually as well as smell. So some flowers are highly fragrant, and those flowers will attract pollinators such as moths who are pollinating at night that are nocturnal. So there's a number of different traits that flowers have to draw insects in to pick up the pollen.
A couple of minutes back, you made reference to the term cross-pollination. Can
right.
you explain that a little further? It sounds like cross-pollination is important for the well-being of many plants. What occurs with cross-pollination, and what makes it significant?
Well, you're basically, it's like having two parents that are unrelated. So you're taking genes from one plant and transferring them to another, and it's the union of those genes that produce the offspring. So the offspring are more genetically diverse and resilient and have less traits or mutations, the possible mutations that it can occur. So outcrossing is always better from a genetic standpoint and the resiliency of a plant or plant community.
But you're talking, I think you're still talking about the same kind of plant or type of plant?
Yes, definitely. So the pollen that is picked up by an insect pollinator needs to be transferred to the same plant species. So flowers receive pollen from another plant that's completely different than what the plant is, it won't obviously fertilize the ovules in that plant. And it can actually kind of clog up the works. So the female parts of the flower waiting to receive pollen will get clogged if it gets covered in pollens from many different kinds of plants.
Others that won't have any effect, I mean, except the negative effect of getting in the way, in a sense.
Right, and that happens regularly. You think of a bee or another pollinator is not consistent in the sequence of the flowers that they visit, so they can switch from one flower to the next of a different species, and so they'll have several different kinds of pollen on their body, so that's quite common.
Hmm. I thought in this same really interesting point you make in this same chapter of your book, not only do plants have various strategies for luring plants, but there are also strategies which plants have, so to speak at least, in terms of avoiding self-pollination.
Right,
avoiding
right.
self-pollination. First of all, I think that probably speaks to what you were just talking about in terms of what would be bad about self-pollination. So what do plants do to help ensure or make that less likely to occur?
One of the main ways that plants avoid self-pollination is to have a sequential development sequence. So most Perfect flowers have both male and female reproductive parts right on the same flower. So there's a high likelihood that once the flower produces pollen, that pollen gets deposited on the female parts of the flower. So to avoid this, they develop over time, usually with the male parts of the flower. The parts that are producing pollen will develop first, and they'll develop pollen, release pollen, finish that process, and once that is done, then the female parts of the flower develop and become receptive. So it really lowers the likelihood that pollen from the flower will get onto the female parts of the flower.
Wow.
So that really plays into insect visitation of flowers. You'll see higher visitations of bees in some cases who are looking for the pollen, visiting when the pollen is being offered, and so they'll be collecting it. And then if you watch a flower develop in a sequence, later when it's near the end of its flowering sequence stage, producing more nectar, then you'll see a lot more visits by insects that are just seeking out nectar. So it can, even over a week time frame in some cases, can be a very fast process, and it can also be kind of a slow process depending on the weather and a number of other factors. But it does play into when insects are visiting what flower when, in a sense.
Nan, you're smiling and kind of shaking your head in wonderment. I mean, you know all of this already, but it's probably just fun to hear it spelled out. It's such an incredible miracle.
You never tire of the world of plants. It's so much more fascinating and complex. You know, we tend to look at a plant and say, oh, that's pretty, or, oh, I don't want that in my yard. But, you know, you forget that these are very complex organisms that have life cycles, you know, perfectly timed to not only insects but to birds and other things. And it's something that you don't see when you just walk past a plant. You know, you really have to get in there and think about it. And, you know, there, as Heather said, there are some plants that have both male and female parts. There are some plants that are male and female in separate parts. So, for example, when you think of American bittersweet, you have to have a male and a female plant, or, you know, groups thereof, so that it can be pollinated appropriately. There are some plants that can change sexes. You know, for example, Jack in the Pulpit can change sex. And so the whole thing is just, it's so exciting and fascinating.
Well, and I think we on the outside, especially we amateurs, tend to look at plants as very static beings. I mean, we know
exactly.
They start out at seeds and then they sprout and they grow and whatever, but beyond that very basic process, we don't think about a lot happening inside a plant or happening between plants. It's this world, this whole living system that is, in a sense, largely invisible to the rest of us.
That's right. And I think aside from food crops, when you think about the world of horticulture, some of that is lost because so many of the plants are hybridized in order to make them more economically successful, you know. So, you know, for example, you know, people love the plant called impatiens, and for a long time they were really bright colors, orange and all those kinds of colors, and they grew in the shade. But then suddenly people say, well, I want this plant, but I want it to grow in the sun, and I want it to be purple. So some very smart horticultural person comes along and manipulates the plant, and then you get something different. So a lot of those, you know, those kinds of interactions and relationships and that sort of living in community idea that goes part and parcel along with native plants gets lost along the way with horticultural species.
Right, when we start manipulating things to that extent.
Right, because we're manipulating them for us. We're not manipulating them for the greater community of living organisms.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us on this edition of The Morning Show, we're joined by Nan Calvert, who joins us once a month under the auspices of the United Environmental Council. And with us on the telephone today is Heather Holm, who is a landscape designer and consultant. Her specialty is native plants, and we're talking with her primarily about her book called pollinators of native plants. Attract, observe, and identify pollinators and beneficial insects with native plants. We've just started talking about the basic process of pollination itself, and we're about to start talking about the way in which certain native insects are actually the most efficient of pollinators, and what we can perhaps do to help ensure that this process can go forward. Heather, do all plants require pollination?
No, not all plants require pollination. There's about 75% of plants, approximately. You know, the number is not exact, but about that many require pollination by some kind of pollinator. So you think of, we have many plants, like Nan mentioned, with separate male and female reproductive parts or flowers on separate plants, and many of those plants are wind pollinated, and that includes our grasses, many of our trees. So it's all the other plants that produce showier flowers that are typically insect pollinated. And it's the vast majority.
We're about to start talking about pollinators of native plants and in a sense, native pollinators. There's actually two things we're talking about here, aren't there? How closely related are they, native pollinators versus the pollination of native plants?
Well, Nan talked about the honeybee in the introduction, and people often base their model of bees on the honeybee because that's what they're most familiar with. But what's really interesting with the native pollinators and native bees in particular is that we just have this huge diversity that most people are unaware of. So just in North America alone, there's over 4,000 species of native bees. And those bees have always been here on the continent in North America. And so they've been co-evolving with all of the native plants on our continent. So they have formed very interesting and intricate relationships with native plants, and in some cases, specialist relationships. So I like to use the example of the monarch butterfly, where the caterpillars will only eat plants in the milkweed genus. And we actually have several specialist relationships with native bees and native plants. And that means that the native bees, the females, who are the ones collecting pollen, will only collect pollen from a really narrow range of plants. So it could be a plant family or more narrowly, like the monarch butterfly, a plant genus that they're collecting pollen from. So the importance of using native plants to attract pollinators helps support these at-risk specialist species as well as all the other types of bees that are more generalist that will visit a wide variety of flower forms and types.
Let's talk a moment about what Nan, you said, is the insect that attracts all the headlines, particularly as of late, because it's been in such a steep decline, and that is what we think of as the honeybee, which actually is not native to America at all. Do we know when and under what circumstances the honeybee came to North America? Nan, do you want to take
yes,
that?
Yes, actually, it's very interesting. For a long time, people thought that the honeybee originated on the African continent. But, you know, with the really exciting and fascinating genome sequencing that people do now, they realize that it actually originated on the Asian continent and was somehow imported to the African continent. And then when Europeans were so good at colonizing places, they brought the honeybee to Europe. And then eventually it ended up in North America. And so what Heather said about our native bee species alone, there are 4,000 different species. Of honeybees, there are only 4 species. So, you know, when you have a disease or a toxin or changes in the climate that can impact a living organism significantly, and you only have 4 species of that particular insect, in other words, the honeybee, you're going to feel it in a big way.
It'll be more devastating.
It's going to be much more devastating, which is not to say that our native insects and our native bees aren't feeling it. They definitely are. There are a lot of pressures on them. Certainly, you know, the lack of native plants in our even in our home landscapes, the overuse of insecticides, you know, the television tells us we must kill all of the insects out there. Well, you know, we must not kill all of the insects out there. It's really important for them because, you know, between they think of how many things eat insects. And not only that, but think of how many plants they're pollinating. If you have 4,000 species of bees alone actively pollinating things on top of other insects doing that, wow, that's pretty amazing. And, you know, clearly we need a great diversity of native plant matter in order to support those species. So so there are a lot of things going on within the honeybee community that are impacting them. And the changes that the beekeeping people are trying to make will also benefit our native insect populations as well. Now, it's quite true that native honeybees don't really use native plant populations. Their mouthparts are different than our native bees. Our native plant flowers, the way that they are, and, you know, there's a crazy diversity of the way flowers appear in the native plant community. But their mouthparts are suited toward those plants. And as Heather said, some of them are specialists. And sometimes that means that the plant is shaped a certain way so that particular insect can take advantage of it, whereas perhaps another native insect can't.
Hmm. So it's just not fit. It doesn't
it just
fit.
It doesn't fit, right. It's like a puzzle. It just doesn't fit quite right.
Interesting. Interesting. Heather, what can you tell us about some of these native species of bees that we don't seem to hear very much about? But you said there were 4,000 of them. I mean, how common are they? I mean, when we see a bee, how likely is it that we might be seeing a native bee versus the more common Eurasian honeybee, which is not native at all?
Right. The native bees are quite common. I mean, obviously there's rare species, but if you go anywhere in the landscape or a plant garden or natural area, you're more likely to see more native bees than you would honeybees, and that really also depends on whether someone is keeping honeybees or a hive is nearby. But people, for example, the most identifiable native bee that people are familiar with are the bumblebees, and you know, east of the Mississippi River, there's about 21 species of bumblebees. So just the bumblebee alone, you can look for different species. And they're the largest and often most charismatic bees that people will see. But there's extremely small bees, too, some that are about the size of a grain of rice. So those smaller species often likely go unnoticed to the casual observer. So like Nan said, it's really important to sort of slow down on your nature walk and look at a patch of flowers and just stand quietly, and that's where you will see a number of types of bees visiting the flowers.
Heather, I'm sure you've seen this many times, but one of my favorite things is to watch a bumblebee pry open a closed gentian and get in there and sort of rumble around. And, you know, the flower is closed around it, but you can see it moving around. You can kind of hear it, and that it emerges just covered in pollen. I mean, these things are so much fun to watch. They're so fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Endless fun for me, whether other people find it that fascinating. But, yeah, it's literally entertainment in your backyard if you take a look for these things happening. Another good example, like the gentian, is the white turtle head, same kind of thing, mm-hmm. where it's people would maybe be familiar with the annual snapdragons that have kind of a elastic-like closure, and our native turtle head is similar, where the bee has to be pretty big in size and have the strength to pry open those elastic closures in order to get into the flower. And it's true, they can spend several minutes in those flowers because those types of complex flower forms will receive fewer visits from pollinators, only the ones that have the strength or size to get inside. So they'll spend quite a bit of time collecting pollen or feeding on nectar once they get in the flower. So yeah, it's quite fun. I find it so entertaining. It's trying to get other folks to catch the bug and to get out in nature and look for these things going on.
I think sometimes people are really frightened of bees because they think, you know, it's going to be like a honeybee. And they're going to sting, and they get bees and wasps confused. And I think once you get people out there and you watch a big bumblebee or you see a mason bee or a carpenter bee doing their thing, and you can talk about how, you know, they're really, you know, they're not aggressive. I mean, they're not the kind of bees that are, they're not colonial, so they're not protecting anything. And I think once you can sort of dial down that fear in people, a lot of awareness can come on board, and hopefully people can move to action and do something about preserving our native pollinators.
Right, I totally agree. People have, everybody's had a bad experience of being stung, and most of the time people are stung by wasps, as you mentioned, the social or the ones that live in colonies. But when bees are out visiting flowers or the buffet, they have no interest in stinging, because stinging is typically a nest defense strategy. So if you get too close to a nest, a wasp nest, for example, you'll get stung. But they typically won't sting while they're out visiting flowers. So as someone who works in gardens all the time, I've never been stung by a bee just working amongst them as they're foraging on flowers. And so if people got a sense of that, that there's nothing to be feared of, and that the bees have no interest in attacking you, in a sense. Now, we do have some bees that the males are a little territorial, so they'll set up a territory perhaps where a female is foraging on flowers, and they may buzz at you, but it's just to stay calm and remember that stinging is very unlikely, and I hopefully people then can enjoy their observations while they're out.
I think German yellow jackets have given every insect a bad name out there.
I think so. Yep. The ground nesting yellow jackets in particular, are people will get stung multiple times if they accidentally step near a nest, and then, like you said, they confuse that incident with it being a bee. Mm-hmm. So then, unfortunately, bees get categorized as being a negative insect rather than a positive insect. So.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about mason bees and carpenter bees?
Sure, yeah. And Greg, I was going to pick up on what Greg said earlier about the differences between the nesting strategies of the honeybee versus our native bees. So most of our native bees nest in the ground. And again, when I tell people that, they immediately think of those yellow jacket wasps that they get stung by who nest in the ground. But even the ones who do nest in the ground, most of the nests are solitary, which means just a single female is excavating a nest, going to flowers to collect pollen and nectar, bringing those materials back to the nest and laying eggs. And that's a pretty short window of around 4 to 6 weeks that she's doing that. And so the other minority of bees nest in cavities, including the mason bees that Nan mentioned. And so cavities can mean a number of different things in the natural landscape. That could include a hole in a standing dead tree that's perhaps created by another insect. But more typically, the cavity nesters are looking for pre-existing holes or hollow plant stems in the landscape. So we like to be tidy as gardeners, unfortunately. I'm saying unfortunately because it really does impact pollinators, because those pollinators need nesting sites from last year's growth of perennial flower stalks. So when we clean up our gardens in the spring and remove all that material, we're taking away potential nesting sites. And so with mason bees, who are many of the species who are active in early spring, and often the species will overlap with when our fruit trees flower, so that's why they've been identified as a very important alternative pollinator to some of our fruit trees, including apples. And so people will construct supplemental nesting sites for these cavity nesting bees, which include hanging containers that are filled with hollow stems so that they have a place to build a nest and then pollinate the plants in early spring in the landscape.
Can we talk about kind of the whole family of what we think of as kind of the stinging insects? I mean, aside from the bees, which we've talked about very extensively, we've touched on wasps, and we haven't yet talked about, for instance, hornets. How do wasps and hornets do when it comes to pollinating, or are they not quite as good at it as bees are, as native bees particularly?
They are flower visitors, and as I mentioned earlier, the wasps and hornets, their diet is primarily carnivorous, so they're out in the landscape hunting other insects. Depending on what kind of wasp they are, it could be very specific. Some of the large solitary wasps will hunt crickets and katydids, for example, so sort of grass or foliage-eating insects. Other wasps will hunt caterpillars, sawfly larvae. So that's where wasps are actually very important to encourage in the landscape, because they are beneficial. They are out hunting these insect populations that can get too large, and they help keep those insect populations in balance. So besides their insect diet, you'll often see wasps visiting flowers later in the summer, and they're just visiting for nectar typically. So there's several plants, native plants in particular, that seem to be very attractive to wasps, and they're often white flowering, which wasps seem to demonstrate a preference for white flowering plants. So this time of year, for example, we have a native plant called boneset. It's in the same, or used to be in the same genus as Joe Pye, and it's a highly attractive plant to wasps, both the social and solitary wasps. So the social wasps are the ones that build the paper colony, whether it's a large conical paper colony above ground in the tree, or if it's the yellow jacket wasp we talked about earlier that will build actually above and below ground, and they're building a paper colony. So it's the social wasps, the ones that live in a colony, that have the highest tendency to sting, because they want to defend their sisters in the nest, and they don't want their whole family to die from a risk of somebody coming by. So
understandable.
Yeah. So the solitary insects have a very low likelihood of stinging versus the colony nesting insects.
How about hornets?
Well, hornets are also wasps. They just have the wasp species have a different common name of hornet.
Oh, interesting.
So bald-faced hornets, which are a large black and white wasp, they are one of the insects that build the big paper colonies up in tree branches.
Oh, yeah.
And typically humans usually don't have run-ins with them, because their nest is usually high enough above the ground where we don't pose a threat to their nest, so we could walk underneath without being stung. And often they go unnoticed until the leaves fall off the trees, and we start to see the paper nests in winter once the leaves have gone.
I noticed that on the cover of your book, there's a little photograph for each of kind of the main families of pollinators. So there's bees, there's butterflies, there's moths, there's wasps, there's beetles, there's flies. And I noticed that the photograph of the whatever kind of fly this is absolutely looks like a bee.
Oh, yes. Flies are, I like to call them chameleons. They're just so fascinating, because many, especially in the syrphid fly family, are mimics. So they like to look like other insects, including bees, like you mentioned, as well as wasps. And the purpose of that is that they are pretty regular flower visitors. So mimicking an insect that looks like a stinging insect helps protect them from predation. So if you're out on an open flower and birds are flying above, the bird may think twice before trying to eat you for lunch if they think that you are a stinging insect and could counterattack. So they... With this mimicry, it provides them with a lot of protection so that they can visit flowers.
What about beetles? That was kind of a surprise to me. I don't think most of us think at all about beetles being in the pollinating business.
Right. There's beetles are probably one of our most diverse types of insects. So there's, you know, thousands and thousands. And there's just a small amount of beetles that visit flowers, including the soldier beetles as well as many of the longhorn beetles. So not all beetles are pollinators. It's just the ones that visit flowers. And the longhorn beetles in particular are common in spring, and you'll see them emerging as adults, visiting flowers, and they'll actually be feeding on both nectar and pollen. So they're, as far as the floral buffet is concerned, they have more than one food source on a flower. And later in the summer, soldier beetles are extremely common this time of year, and they're the ones featured on the book cover. So they're the yellow and black insects. And so not only are they somewhat good pollinators, many of the larvae of that beetle are aphid eaters. So it's a nice way to attract these beetles as adults with particular types of native plants, and then they're helping to keep your aphid population in balance while their larvae are developing in your garden. So there's a nice relationship between attracting adults and getting some extra benefits. And the same holds true with the syrphid flies I mentioned earlier. There's a large subfamily in that family of flies that the larvae look like caterpillar-like, and they will be just devouring soft-bodied insects, including aphids, in our garden. So they're not only pollinating plants, but they're, you know, dual, more than one service is being provided by these insects.
As we head into the last minutes of our program, Nan, maybe you can help frame where this conversation needs to end with what the problem is. Where it is where we are getting in the way, where we can step back and try to allow this process to, in a sense, go on unfettered. Is it that we need more of these pollinators, or is it that we need more of these native plants for these pollinators to pollinate? Or, if there is a problem in the balance of things, where is that problem right now?
To your questions, yes and yes. So the balance is upset because we've replaced our native landscapes with non-native landscapes, and some of those landscapes are now dominated by exotic, aggressive, invasive species that don't do anybody any good. So, yes. It's so easy to provide even a small home for these insects. You know, even if you live in a tiny place where, or perhaps you live in an apartment or you live in a condo, even just hanging out a nesting box for mason bees will do them a good turn. Because as Heather said, you know, they're looking for deadfall. They're looking for wood that already has holes in it, or they're looking for hollow plant stems that stay up. You know, as Heather said, we tend to be, we clear everything out, you know, because it has to be perfect. There can't be anything messy and unorganized in our landscapes. And really, those are two mindsets that we need to let go of. So you can go online and look for plans to build your own mason bee nesting boxes. And I would encourage you to patronize a local person. His name is Arthur Carlson, and he has an Etsy site. It's called Good Riddance Farm. And all you have to do is Google him, and he's extremely artistic. And his boxes are two specs. In other words, they are built and designed with the right size holes and the right spaces between them so that the mason bees will take up residence in them. So the answer is plant native plants. We need lots more native plants. We need to learn how to manage our landscapes so that they're not these sterile places that don't support a diversity of life. And it's really about knowledge, and it's about building awareness and then knowledge and then action. Because once you begin to delve into this whole great melange of native plants and native insects, it's just very exciting. It's good for your head and good for your soul. And I just want to quick say something about pollen. You know, people hate pollen because it makes them sneeze. And I'm one of those people. But I don't hate pollen. And people tend to think of it as this sort of generic yellowish powder. But when you look at pollen grains under an electron microscope, every single plant has a specific pollen grain. It looks completely different than the next one. And you can look at a pollen grain, or smarter people than me can look at a pollen grain, and they can tell what tree it came from or what plant it came from. And the pollen grains are just beautiful. And if you go out to Google Images and, you know, you just Google in, you know, magnified pollen grains, it's amazing. It's just amazing. And I know that sounds completely nerdy, but it really is very amazing.
I'm sure it is. Heather Holm, do you have anything to add in terms of what you hope people will kind of take away from this conversation and things that they can do in their own lives?
I think the one thing I would mention is we hear about the honeybee being in trouble, but many of our native bees are at risk of extinction, or you know, their ranges are declining, and so that, like Nan said, they just need forage. Many don't have the ability to disperse very far, so even if you get together with your neighbors and you each put in a small patch of a pollinator planting, you're helping to support local bee populations because they don't have the ability to get somewhere else where it's better. So if collectively, if everybody had their own little patch of pollinator paradise in their yard, it would allow bees to move more freely through the rent landscape, and it would just help more bee populations.
Yes, and if anybody in our listening area is interested in doing that and you need help with that, you need to know where to start, give me a call. We would be happy to help you.
Hmm. Heather Holm, we're going to let you go, but not before thanking you for writing this very interesting book and for joining us today on The Morning Show. We want to remind people that your book is called Pollinators of Native Plants: Attract, Observe, and Identify Pollinators and Beneficial Insects with Native Plants. It's a beautiful book, chock full of vibrant color photographs of all these beautiful insects and outlining the important work which they do out in the world of nature. So thank you for this good work that you've done and for joining us today on The Morning Show. It's been great to have you.
Thank you so much, Greg and Nan. It was great.
Whoops. And I think I just disconnected her accidentally. Pretty rude. We'll call her back in just a moment to say a proper goodbye. But again, Heather Holm, we're appreciative of her presence on The Morning Show today. And before I forget, I want to remind everybody that a week from today, we're going to actually be talking with two representatives of the Kenosha Racine Beekeepers Association. In case anyone listening is intrigued by the possibility of actually going kind of a step further and actually raising some bees. It's a fascinating field, although it's not one you want to enter without knowing what you're doing. So that will be a conversation occurring next Thursday on The Morning Show. Nan, give us the calendar events, if you would.
I will. So on September 12th, from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., there will be a woodland festival and pig roast at Sino Conservancy. You can come for the whole day, or you can just come for dinner, whatever you would like to do. We will have live music. We're going to have demonstrations and displays, tours, games for young and the young at heart. We're going to have really cool artistic make and takes. And if you want to, you will be able to make your own mason bee house while you're there, among other things. So if you would like to come to this festival, and you really should come to the festival, give me a call at 539-3222, and we'll get you all set up for that. Chiwaukee Prairie Preservation Fund, on August 15th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., you will meet at Chiwaukee Prairie. One of the things you'll do is scout for purple loosestrife and hairy willow herb, and you're going to be removing other invasives as well. Tools and equipment are provided, but you need to bring something to drink and your lunch, and of course, dress appropriately. It's a good idea to have a hat and long sleeves, pants you can tuck into your socks. And thirdly, the Sierra Club Southeast Gateway Group, on August 22nd from 9 a.m. to noon, they're going to have a weed out event at Colonial Park to remove invasive species. They provide the tools also. Bring your own water, wear long sleeves, and sturdy shoes. How's that?
That was great.
Come to the Woodland Festival at Sino Conservancy in Burlington. You're going to love it.
What date is that again?
That would be September 12th from 11 to 7 p.m.
Very good. And we'll look forward to seeing you in September at some point.
Yes, indeed.
Very good. Nan Calvert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Tomorrow, Dr. Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events. Support for the morning show comes from the generosity of Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Today is going to be mostly sunny and warmer than it's been, with a high of 87 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight with a 40% chance of rain, a low of 68. Tomorrow, partly sunny, a 30% chance of rain and a high of 89. And both Saturday and Sunday under sunny skies, our forecast high Saturday and Sunday, 90 degrees. Not nearly so warm on Monday. We'll have more cloudy skies and a 50% chance of rain. Monday's high, just 80 degrees.